The next chapter is chapter 22, Israel 1, a Jewish supremacist state. And this is the first of three chapters on Israel, chapters that expose the supremacist racial nature of the state of Israel, its terrorism, its theft, its destructiveness, the damage that it's caused not just against the Palestinian people and other peoples in the Middle East, but also against the American people. In these chapters, you're going to find some very fascinating data. In fact, proof that Israel committed terrorism. Yes, I say terrorism against the United States of America. These chapters will also be made into a special zip file, be brought together, and be made available free on the internet as a good foundation of the realities of the state of Israel and the plight of the Palestinian people, and in fact, the American people. As I delved deeper into the Jewish question in Zionism, attempting to get a clear understanding of this enigmatic people, I realized that exploring the foundations and policies of the modern nation of Israel would answer some of my questions. For the first time in over 2,000 years, Jews had their own sovereign state, a nation created entirely in their own image. By the time I began my inquiry, it was obvious to me that the press and the entertainment industry were very pro-Israel. They had induced in me an early prejudice in favor of Israel. I now noticed that the reporters covering the stories for the TV networks and for the major newspapers are usually Jewish. Suspecting that much of my pro-Israel sentiment had come from biased sources, I sought to learn the indisputed basics of the Mideast conflict, and I first turned to my encyclopedias. I found in my encyclopedias information similar to what one will find today in the Israel article in the very popular Encarta encyclopedia. And I quote, "Of the more than 800,000 Arabs who lived in Israeli-held territory before 1948, only about 170,000 remained. The rest became refugees in surrounding Arab countries. In 1948, the year the Israeli nation was set up, more than three-fourths of the entire Palestinian population living in the Israeli-held territory had become refugees. According to Encarta, 630,000 people were no longer able to dwell in their homes and to work on the land where their families had lived for thousands of years. Since then, Israel expanded its borders in the wars of 56, 67, and 73, and in the Lebanon invasion of 1982, creating hundreds of thousands of additional Palestinian refugees. Would people voluntarily leave their homes, their businesses, their farms? I ask myself. Would they freely choose to live as penniless, stateless people in squalid refugee camps? Obviously, the Zionists had driven them from their homes and property, and furthermore, the expulsion had obviously been intentional, for the Palestinians were forbidden to return to their homes after the fighting ended. While in high school, I wrote to a Palestinian information organization in Washington, D.C., and asked for some books giving their side of the Israeli-Arab conflict. From them and the libraries, I obtained many well-documented sources, including some amazing Zionist ones, that gave a very different answer to the Mideast question than what I got in my media. I learned that the fledgling Israeli government had passed regulations forbidding the expelled Palestinians from returning to their homes and property. They also enacted a special law that deemed this Arab property, quote, abandoned, unquote, and subject to confiscation without compensation. The Nazis of Hitler's Reich could not have disposed of the problem with any more cold-blooded efficiency. I checked the figures compiled by the British census in 1922. At that time, Jews accounted for only 10% of the population. In the last census, taken the year before the establishment of Israel, Jews made up only about half of the population within the area that subsequently became Israel. The Palestinians then owned 93.5% of the land. The facts were inescapable and damning. Zionist immigrants had forced their way into Palestine against the wishes of the inhabitants, and then, through the weight of arms and terror, had driven the residents from their homes, robbing them of their land and possessions. The facts could not be any more plain. The Zionists, with help from their cohorts all over the world, had stolen a whole nation, the nation called Israel. No equivocation, no mountain of pro-Israeli propaganda, no playing of Exodus on the radio, and no replay of millions of feet of Hollywood films showing Arabs as brutal terrorists and Jews as innocent victims. None of this could change the obvious and inescapable facts. The pro-Israeli propaganda I read suggested that Palestine was essentially an empty country. Tell that to the more than 1 million people who have been driven out since 1948. Zionist leaders understood from the beginning that Israel was going to be acquired by colonization and conquest. The dedicated Zionist leader, Vladimir Jabotinsky, makes this clear in his 1923 book, The Iron Wall, We and the Arabs. Quote, Zionist colonization must either be terminated or carried out against the wishes of the native population, an iron wall, to resist the pressure of the native population. A voluntary reconciliation with the Arabs is out of the question, for without an armed force, colonization is impossible. Zionism is a colonization adventure. It is important to speak Hebrew, but more important to be able to shoot. Israel was born of the Holocaust, but it was sired thousands of years before then. For at least 2,000 years, Jews prayed, next year in Jerusalem. And until the middle of the 20th century, such prayer was only a religious metaphor. Then, dramatically, in 1948, the possibility of next year in Jerusalem became a possibility for every Jew in the world. The political machinations of the Zionist state are testimony to the cohesive and pervasive Jewish power in the West. In its operation, Israel lives as testimony to the very supremacist nature of both Judaism and its partly secular son, Zionism. Jewish messianic tradition goes back as far as the recorded history. Even when the Jews were one of the smallest tribes in the Middle East, they fashioned a faith that designated themselves a special people, a chosen people, a people who were promised to rule the world. These messianic intentions are not paranoid delusions of anti-Semites, but are written plainly in their own Hebraic scriptures. And since that time, they have been dutifully appended, even to the present day. Compare the following biblical quotation to the messianic words of Israel's first prime minister, David Ben Gurion. And I quote, and this is from Jubilees 32:18-19, and king shall come from you and shall rule wherever the foot of the sons of man has trodden. I shall give you your seed, all the earth which is under heaven, and they shall rule over all the nations according to their desire, and afterwards they shall draw the whole earth to themselves and shall inherit it forever. In Look magazine, in 1962, Ben-Gurion stated his prediction for the next 25 years. The prediction of amazing prescience was this, quote, the image of the world in 1987, as traced in my imagination, the Cold War will be a thing of the past. Internal pressure on the constantly growing intelligentsia in Russia may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. With the exception of the USSR as a federated Eurasian state, all other continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished. There'll be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, a truly united nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. And this will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind. Unquote. Many people are amazed to discover that most Jews in Israel are non-religious, just as was their first great leader, David Ben-Gurion. However, these mostly atheistic Jews tolerate a religious state. Apparently, Jews who have no belief in God support Judaism as a state-sponsored institution that preserves both Jewish culture and the Jewish genotype. Other than a few intolerant fanatics, the Jewish Orthodox institutions allow a wide range of religious belief, from atheism to forms of the occult called Kabbalism. Only the Talmud could have a passage where a rabbi claims to have argued with God and then defeated him. To Jewish orthodoxy, biblical and theological interpretations may vary greatly as long as Jewish tradition and Jewish heritage is scrupulously preserved. Next section is God a Zionist. Now, Israel supports its claim on Palestinian land by saying that God gave it to the Jews. A corollary secular argument is that the remote ancestors of the Jewish people lived 2,000 years ago on parts of what is now Israel. They argue with a straight face that this gives them the right to take that land away from whoever has lived on the land during the intervening years. Now, that argument is much like saying that because the Romans had ruled the Mediterranean 2,000 years ago, the Italians now have the right to conquer the entire Mediterranean basin and drive out 3/4 of its population. Furthermore, the Jewish people cannot claim that they were the first people dwelling in the Promised Land. The Bible clearly records Jewish invasions and genocide in the region. The Palestinian people are descended from the same peoples who lived in the area before the Jewish conquests. If the claim that whoever lived on the land first has the rightful claim, then the Palestinians should have the primary claim to the land because many of their ancestors lived on that same land long before ancient Israel even existed. The allegation that Jewish rule over Palestine today is God-ordained poses a more difficult question, especially for contemporary Christians. It is difficult because the Jewish power brokers have been able to completely change 2,000 years of Christian interpretation of the Bible. Servile Judeo-Christian preachers have made alliances with the Zionists because of their media power. They quote liberally from Old Testament verses that proclaim a covenant between God and the Israelites that bequeaths the land referred to as Israel to the Jews. The Christian Church of our fathers, though, from its earliest history up to recent times, has always refuted that claim. Christian scholars, from the writers of the New Testament itself to the midpoint of the 20th century, pointed out that the Bible makes it very clear that all promises made by God are conditional upon continued faithfulness. God says clearly in the Old Testament that if the Israelites reject him, he will requite them. The New Testament emphatically makes the point that the Jewish nation, by rejecting God and his Son, has dissolved the Old Testament. New Testament scriptures quote God as making a new covenant with a new promise of salvation of Christ for all. As I previously quoted, the scriptures cannot possibly be any more explicit than in Hebrews 8:10, in which God says very clearly that the Jews are no longer in the covenant he made in the Old Testament. Quote, "Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord." Unquote. Is it any wonder that Jews reject the New Testament and that Israel forbids even quoting it in their schools? Government-funded groups in Israel have even organized public burnings of the New Testament, and Israeli laws provide for criminal prosecution and 5-year imprisonment for Christians who seek to convert Jews. It seems quite odd in the light of these facts that many denominations of the Christian church are now busily adopting the view that Jews are still today the chosen people. It is understandable that supremacist Jews who reject Christ and the New Testament would say that God sanctions their terror against the Palestinian people, but it is scandalous that Christians could possibly support them in this bloody adventure. Many of those who suffered from the Zionist onslaught were in fact Christian Palestinians. Israel's crimes have significantly hurt the many Christians among the Palestinian people. The fact that some Christian leaders lend moral and financial support to a nation that hates and oppresses Christians is testimony to the penetration and subversion of Zionist power and influence, even into the highest councils of various Christian denominations. In doing so, they have undermined the Christian faith in the entire Mideast, and indeed in the entire world. The Israeli claim that God gave them the land of Israel is ludicrous when one considers that at least 3/4 of Israelis don't even believe in God in the first place. Israeli government statistics say 85% do not believe in God. Now, how can a God that they do not believe in promise them land that belongs to others? Far from being a religious promise, Israel's creation came not from divine intervention, but from Zionist intrigue that began during the First World War. This is from my book, Jewish Supremacism, from Chapter 9, Israel, a Supremacist State. And we're going to go into the Balfour Declaration. We're talking about the origins of Israel, and the Balfour Declaration laid the foundation for Israel, and this is what we'll discuss first, and some other major issues in the foundation of what's called the Israeli State. The First World War laid the political foundation of the Zionist state. Britain was having a tough time of it. For years, the war had droned on, causing horrendous loss of life. Despite oceans of spilled blood, the front lines had moved only a few kilometers back and forth on the Western Front. Jewish loyalties were somewhat divided during the war. Some Jews favored the Allies for business and other reasons. Others favored the Germans for the main reason that German success against Russia would weaken their longtime enemies, Imperial Russia and the Tsar. Just a decade earlier, financiers Jacob Schiff and Bernard Baruch led a campaign to finance the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War, resulting in a defeat for Russia. Now, Jewish power brokers around the world hoped for an even more calamitous Russian defeat in the Great War to provide an opportunity to overthrow the Tsar and establish a Jewish Bolshevik government. The Germans, desperately fighting a war on two fronts, knew that a revolution in Russia might remove Russia from the war. Toward that end, Kaiser Wilhelm approved one of the most treacherous deeds in the annals of Western civilization. In his zeal to defeat Russia, his ministers assisted Lenin, Trotsky, and hundreds of other Bolshevik revolutionaries, mostly Jewish, to cross Germany in a sealed train toward Russia, allowing the Bolshevik terrorists and assassins access to Russia, unleashed the greatest period of human oppression, torture, and murder that the world has perhaps ever experienced. Britain and her allies fought to a stalemate against Germany, but as Russia weakened, the Allies knew that her defeat would allow the entire German army on the Eastern Front to almost double their army on the Western Front. dramatically tipping the military balance toward the Central Powers. Britain understood that it was critical that they bring the United States into the war on the Allies' side to counter the Russian collapse. Onto the stage of crisis stepped the British Lord Arthur Balfour. He met with the Rothschilds and made an agreement that in return for pledging Britain's support in the creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, that the Jews would use their great international power and influence to draw the United States into the war. Lord Balfour drew up a document, the Balfour Declaration, that called for a Jewish homeland. Even our popular encyclopedias admit the reason for the Balfour Declaration. This is from the Encarta Encyclopedia. It has been commonly accepted that the Balfour Declaration was a unilateral undertaking by the British government. The immediate purpose was to win for the Allied cause in World War I the support of Jews and others in the warring nations and in neutral countries such as the United States. Now read what David Lloyd George, Britain's wartime prime minister, wrote about the Balfour Declaration. Note his pointing out that the Jews of Russia had been the chief agents in the betrayal of the Russian war effort as well as the disintegration of Russian society, later recognized as the Revolution. Russian Jews had been secretly active on behalf of the Central Powers from the first. By 1917, they had done much in preparing for that general disintegration of Russian society, later recognized as the Revolution. It was believed that if Great Britain declared for the fulfillment of Zionist aspirations in Palestine under their own pledge, one effect would be to bring Russian Jewry to the cause of the Entente. It was believed also that such a declaration would have a potent influence upon world Jewry outside Russia and secure for the Entente the aid of Jewish financial interests. In America, their aid in this respect would have a special value when the Allies had almost exhausted the gold and marketable securities available for American purchase. Such were the chief considerations which, in 1917, impelled the British government toward making a contract with Jewry. Unquote. Samuel Lanman, in his book Great Britain, the Jews in Palestine, confirms the Jewish role in bringing America into the war. Lanman, a leading Zionist and secretary of the Zionist organization from 1917 to 22, confirms from the Jewish perspective exactly what Lloyd George says. Quote, "The only way, which proved so to be, to induce the American president to come into the war was to secure the cooperation of Zionist Jews by promising them Palestine and thus enlist and mobilize the hitherto unsuspectingly powerful forces of Zionist Jews in America and elsewhere in favor of allies on a quid pro quo contract basis." Unquote. Some of the President Wilson's top advisors during the period were the Jewish Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, Rabbi Stephen Wise, and the powerful banker and international financier of New York City, Bernard Baruch. Although Wilson had campaigned for president on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war," once the Balfour Declaration was proposed, Jewish influence quickly pushed him to an interventionist path. When Balfour came to the United States in May 1917 in hopes of pulling America into the war, he ignored the U.S. State Department, which, by the way, created much resentment, and met with Brandeis, who had no authority to speak on foreign relations. The Jewish protagonists for war were also aided in their jingoism by a number of American magnates who saw American participation in the European conflict as writing a blank check for the military industrial complex. The press that was Jewish-owned or Jewish-controlled agitated unashamedly for war, running lurid tales of German atrocities and promoting stories that Germany planned to invade the United States through Mexico, even though in 4 years of war it had been unable to even take Paris. In short order, the Germans, although racially and morally no different than British and Americans, were labeled Huns and baby killers. The Allies, despite Britain's and France's non-democratic foreign empires, were said to be fighting for, quote, democracy, even though Germany had electoral institutions similar to those of the Allies. It was called tyrannical. The two prominent slogans for the greatest and bloodiest war in all of history were, quote, the war to make the world safe for democracy. And incredibly, the war to end war. If those were truly the Allied objectives of the First World War, it's easy to see the fruits of their victory as the 20th century closed and the 21st century began. Democracy around the world still seems to be in precious short supply, and war since 1918 has been a thriving business. Most historians now agree that the First World War was not the result of aggression or dictatorship or any sinister force other than entangling alliances structured to preserve the balance of power. Essentially, it was promoted by nothing but national fears and bravado. For most of the internecine conflict, America sensibly stayed out of this war's insanity. But finally, Jewish power, whose concern, as always, was only its own interests, tipped the scales for war. After all, what were the lives of a few hundred thousand young Americans compared to the interests of the chosen? The media keeps Americans blind to the Jewish influence in our participation in the First World War, just as they cloaked the pivotal Jewish involvement in the Russian Revolution. The world didn't even learn until 1999 that the person working with Lord Balfour was actually a Jew, and that while ostensibly working for Britain's interest, he was secretly working on behalf of the World Zionist Organization. Even this day, to this day, few Americans are aware of the preeminent Jewish influence directly resulting in America's involvement in the First World War. The Balfour Declaration was innocuous sounding enough, and it took pains to state, and I quote, that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. The Zionists, though, did not want a homeland containing a significant non-Jewish community. From the outset, they were determined not to set up a multicultural, pluralistic democracy that they were so busy planning for America and the rest of the European world. They wanted a chauvinistic, ethno-religious, purely Jewish state. But they could not reveal this until they had attained power in Palestine. Among themselves, though, they made clear their intentions to create an ethnic state, one amazingly similar to the nation they most hated, Nazi Germany. Next section, Zionism, Nazism, born in each other's image. In the Nuremberg War Crimes trials, Julius Streicher, the notorious publisher of the Nazi magazine Der Stürmer, gave the following testimony when asked if he had helped develop Germany's racial laws. The accused, Streicher, quote, yes, I have been writing that all mixing of German and Jewish blood had to be prevented in the future. I wrote articles to that effect, and I've always repeated that we had to take the Jewish race or the Jewish people as a model. I've always repeated in my articles that the Jews were to be regarded as a model by other races, for they have given themselves a racial law, the law of Moses, which says, quote, if you go into foreign lands, you must not take foreign wives. And this, gentlemen, is of great importance in judging the Nuremberg laws. It was these Jewish laws that were taken as a model. When centuries later the Jewish legislator Ezra saw that, despite this, many Jews had married non-Jewish wives, these bonds were broken. This was the origin of Jewry, which, thanks to its racial laws, survived for centuries, whereas all the other races and civilizations were destroyed. Unquote. The racial awakening in Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries grew in great part because of the presence of the Jewish people. There were no blacks or orientals in Europe, but there was no shortage of Jews. Scientific and social observers noted that their character and appearance differed from those of the indigenous races of Europe. One of the first major figures to recognize the dynamic power of race and to write extensively about it was the British Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, who himself was of Jewish origin. He stated, quote, the racial question is the key to world history. All is race. There's no other truth." Unquote. Scholars who recognize the role of race in history knew that the power and perseverance of the Jewish race rests in its ethnocentrism and prohibitions against intermarriage, enabling it to survive after 2,000 years of living among Gentiles. As Stryker's testimony proves, the formulators of European racial ideology had learned a lot from studying Jewish institutions and history. Although Zionists and Nazis saw each other as mortal enemies, many of the leaders of both movements had extremely similar ideas, and many collaborated in pursuit of their mutual aims. The National Socialists wanted their own nation free of Jewish influence, and the Zionists sought non-assimilation with Gentiles and a nation of their own. Even today in modern America and Europe, most major Jewish organizations mightily oppose intermarriage. At first glance, it seems unbelievable that Zionism and Nazism sometimes had worked together, but the historical record reveals fascinating and copious evidence. Most Jews in Europe and the rest of the world virulently opposed Hitler and the National Socialist Government of Germany. In fact, as Hitler gained power in 1933, the World Jewish Congress, claiming to speak for Jews worldwide, declared economic war on Germany and announced their intention to do everything in their power to destroy Germany and National Socialism. Within the Jewish community, however, there were many Zionists who saw the anti-Semitic policies of Germany as an aid to the creation of the Jewish state. They saw those policies as encouraging immigration to Palestine and increasing Jewish anger and solidarity. And interestingly, they viewed the racial thinking of Hitler as analogous to what they desired for their own people. For these Jews, collusion between Zionists and the Nazis served the interests of both. Britain had difficulty in dealing with the increased Jewish immigration to Palestine in the 1930s, and it caused marked unrest in the Arab sectors of the Mandate. To lessen tensions, the British attempted to limit Jewish immigration into Palestine. And to this opportunity stepped Hitler and Nazi Germany. Hitler had misgivings about Israel becoming a center for international Jewish power in the same way the Soviet Union had become one for international communism. Although he had concerns about damaging German relations with the Arab world, he saw the immigration of Jews from Germany and all Europe as being of a paramount importance. In his mind, a Jewish state in Palestine might be a practical destination for Europe's Jews, although he favored the far less populated and larger island of Madagascar. From the earliest days of Hitler's rise to power, the leading Zionist organization in Germany sought out common ground with him. Within months of Hitler's achieving the chancellorship, the Zionist Federation of Germany presented him with a statement suggesting that Zionism could solve the, quote, Jewish question, unquote. And by the way, the documentation for all these quotes is in my book, Jewish Supremacism, in this chapter. And you can check out these quotations and documents for yourself. They are certainly amazing, but they can be proven without any shadow of a doubt. And here's the quotation. In the foundation of the new state, which has proclaimed the race principle. Now again, this is the Zionist Federation of Germany speaking. We wish to adapt our community to these new structures. Our recognition of the Jewish nationality allows us to establish clear and sincere relations with the German people and its national and racial realities, precisely because we do not want to underestimate these fundamental principles, because we too are against mixed marriages and for the maintaining of the purity of the Jewish group. Zionism believes that the rebirth of the national life of a people, which is now occurring in Germany through the emphasis on its Christian and national character, must also come about in the Jewish national group. For the Jewish people, too, national origin, religion, common destiny, and a sense of its uniqueness must be of decisive importance in the shaping of its existence. We are not blind to the fact that a Jewish question exists and will continue to exist. From the abnormal situation of the Jews, severe disadvantages result for them, but also scarcely tolerable conditions for other peoples. Unquote. Joachim Prinz, a German Zionist who immigrated to the United States and who later became head of the American Jewish Congress, wrote in his 1934 book, Wir Juden, We Jews, that the National Socialist Revolution in Germany meant Jewry for the Jews. Prince, in later years, also wrote scathingly about Adolf Hitler's view of the importance of race, but hypocritically showed no reluctance to defend the concept of the Jewish race. And here's a direct quote from his writings. We want assimilation to be replaced by a new law, the declaration of belonging to the Jewish nation and the Jewish race, a state built upon the principle of the purity of nation and race, can only be honored and respected by a Jew who declares his belonging to his own kind. No subterfuge can save us now. In place of assimilation, we desire a new concept, recognition of the Jewish nation and Jewish race. Now, this is a man who became head of the American Jewish Congress, one of the most powerful and largest Jewish organizations in the United States of America. In his key book of Modern Zionism, The Jewish State, Theodor Herzl maintained that the Jews were much more than a religious community. They were a people. Herzl even used the well-known German racialist word, Volk, to describe them. Volk was also one of Hitler's favorite words. With it, he described his ideal state, the Volkische Staat. Herzl wrote, long before Hitler's rise, that anti-Semitism is a natural reaction to Gentiles to Jews. He advocated a separate state as the only real answer to the conflict. And I quote, the Jewish question exists wherever Jews live in noticeable numbers. Where it does not exist, it is brought in by arriving Jews. I believe I understand anti-Semitism, which is a very complex phenomenon. I consider this development, as a Jew, without hate or fear. It's a national question. To solve it, we must above all make an international political issue a final solution to the Jewish question. Unquote. The leading German Zionist newspaper, Jüdische Rundschau, in 1935 even went so far as to express approval of the Nuremberg Laws, designating Jews as an alien nationality and forbidding intermarriage and sexual relations between Germans and Jews. I'll quote, the new law gives the Jewish minority in Germany its own cultural life, its own national life, and the future will be able to shape its own schools, its own theater, its own sports associations. In short, it can create its own future in all aspects of national life. Unquote. George Koreski, the former head of the largest Jewish community in Western Europe, that of Berlin, and the leader of the Zionist State Organization and Jewish Cultural League, made the following comment to the Berlin Daily Der Angriff at the end of 1935, and I quote, for many years, I have regarded a complete separation of the cultural affairs of the two peoples, Jews and Germans, as a precondition for living together without conflict. I have long supported such a separation, provided it's founded on respect for the alien nationality. The Nuremberg Laws seem to me, apart from their legal provisions, to conform entirely with the desire for a separate life based on mutual respect. This interruption of the process of dissolution in many Jewish communities, which had been promoted through mixed marriages, is therefore, from a Jewish point of view, entirely welcome. Unquote. Other leading Zionists around the world spoke similarly. Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, president of the American Jewish Congress and the World Jewish Congress, speaking before a rally in New York in 1938, said, and I quote, I am not an American citizen of the Jewish faith. I am a Jew. I am an American. I've been an American for 63/64 of my life, but I've been a Jew for 4,000 years. Hitler was right in one thing. He calls the Jewish people a race, and we are a race. Unquote. Not only did the Nazis and the Zionists cooperate with each other, they actively collaborated up to and even during the Second World War. The Nazi government set up a series of 40 agricultural centers throughout Germany to train young Jews for kibbutz life in Palestine. It supported immigration of Jews to Palestine until prevented by the war. The official SS newspaper, Das Schwarze Korps, supported Zionism in front page editorials. The SS collaborated with the Haganah, the Zionist underground military in Palestine, with help in Jewish immigration, and even provided smuggled guns for Zionist forces, despite misgivings. Hitler continued to support Zionist objectives in Palestine. Hitler told his army adjutant in 1939 and again in 1941 that he had asked the British in 1937 about transferring all of Germany's Jews to Palestine or Egypt. The British rejected the proposal, he said, because it would cause further disorder in those countries. As the British government became more restrictive on Jewish immigration to Palestine in the late 1930s, the SS made a pact with the secret Zionist agency Mossad Li Aliyah Bet to smuggle Jews into Palestine. As a result of this collaboration, Jewish migration, both legal and illegal, from Germany, including Austria, to Palestine increased dramatically in 1938 and 1939. 10,000 Jews were scheduled for immigration in October 1939, but the beginning of the war prevented it. During 1940 and 41, as late as March 1942, Germany still assisted with indirect Jewish immigration to Palestine and had at least one officially authorized Zionist kibbutz training camp in Germany for potential immigrants. As a side note, this is in March 1942 with the war waging full bore. The German government is training Zionist leaders in Germany. Amazing, isn't it? In the economic sphere, the Havara Agreement between the Nazi Germans and the Palestinian Center of the World Zionist Organization was vital to the Zionist cause. It began in 1933 and lasted throughout the 1930s and allowed the transfer of Jewish wealth to Palestine. Through this pact, Hitler's Third Reich did more than any other government during the 1930s to support Jewish development in Palestine. And another side note, you know, it's how many times have the Jews condemned nations that cooperated with Hitler and that didn't go to war against Hitler earlier, even the United States? And yet here's a situation where the foundations of Israel cooperated hand and foot with Hitler's regime in Germany. I'll continue. Probably the most telling document of the willingness of some Zionist factions to enter an alliance with Hitler was the offer made in 1941 by the Fighters for Freedom of Israel, popularly called the Lehi, or the Stern Gang. One of its top officials was Yitzhak Shamir, who later became the leader and chief terrorist after Stern's death, and who later became Israel's prime minister in the 1980s. The Stern Gang considered the British to be Zionism's biggest enemy because Great Britain tried to protect the civil rights of the native Palestinians and attempted to slow the insurgent Jewish immigration. In one of the most amazing facts of modern history, the Lehi actually made a formal proposal to the Germans of a military alliance between the Jewish Revolutionary Organization and the Nazis. In effect, they formally proposed to join the war on Germany's side. Now, here is a text of portions of their communique with the Nazis. Quote, "In their speeches and statements, the leading statesmen of National Socialist Germany have often emphasized that a new order in Europe requires a prerequisite, a radical solution of the Jewish question by evacuation, a Jew-free Europe. The evacuation of the Jewish masses from Europe is a precondition for solving the Jewish question. However, the only way this can be totally achieved is through settlement of these masses in the homeland of the Jewish people, Palestine, and by establishment of a Jewish state in its historical boundaries. The goal of the political activity and the years of struggle by the Israel Freedom Movement, the national military organization in Palestine, Irgun Zvei Lumi, is to solve the Jewish problem in this way and thus completely liberate the Jewish people forever. The NMO, which is very familiar with the goodwill of the German Reich government and its officials towards Zionist activities within Germany and the Zionist immigration program, takes the view that 1. Common interests can exist between a European new order based on the German concept and a true national aspiration of the Jewish people as embodied by the NMO. 2. Cooperation is possible between the new Germany and a renewed folkish national Jewry. 3. The establishment of the historical Jewish state on a national and totalitarian basis and bound by treaty with the German Reich would be in the interest of maintaining and strengthening the future German position of power in the Near East. On the basis of these considerations, and upon the condition that the German Reich government recognized the national aspirations of the Israeli freedom movement mentioned above, the MMO in Palestine offers to actively take part in the war on the side of Germany. This offer by the MMO could include military, political, and informational activity within Palestine and, after certain organizational measures, outside as well. The indirect participation of the Israel Freedom Movement in the new order of Europe already in the preparatory stage, combined with a positive, radical solution of the European Jewish problem on the basis of the national aspirations of the Jewish people mentioned above, would greatly strengthen the moral foundation of the new order in the eyes of all humanity. The cooperation of the Israel Freedom Movement would also be consistent with a recent speech by the German Reich Chancellor in which Hitler stressed that he would utilize any combination and coalition in order to isolate and defeat England. Unquote. No records exist of the German response to the amazing proposal, but by the time it was offered, Germany had already committed itself to a pro-Arab posture in an attempt to undermine Britain's position in the Middle East. When I first saw this document, I noticed the ideological similarities between Zionism and National Socialism, right down to the use of the favorite Nazi word, Völkisch, to describe the foundations of the state that they wanted to create. It fascinated me to read about Zionist collusion with Nazi Germany. Zionist-Nazi collaboration has long been a dirty little secret, one that speaks volumes about the ideological foundations of Israel and the lengths to which Zionist extremists would go to secure its creation. Zionist fanaticism had little regard for human lives, including that of Jews. When it came to the establishment of Israel, Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, made the following statement when German Jewry was threatened by Hitler. Quote, and this is an amazing statement. Quote, if I knew that it would be possible to save all the children in Germany by bringing them over to England, and only half of them by transporting them to Eretz Yisrael, then I would opt for the second alternative. For we must weigh not only the life of these little children, but also the history of the people of Israel. Unquote. If Israel's first prime minister, if his regard for Jewish life was such that he would rather see half of the Jewish children of Germany die than be transported to England rather than Israel, how much value could one expect him to place on the life of a Palestinian child? How would the world react to a Nazi who would say that he would rather see half the Jewish children die rather than simply go to another country? Another classic example of this low regard for human life, even Jewish life, can be seen in the 1940 terrorist act by Ben-Gurion and the founders of the Zionist state. The Haganah, led by Ben-Gurion, blew up a ship of Jewish refugees from Hitler. The British had been taking them to the Mauritius rather than allowing them to disembark in Haifa, Israel. To arouse indignation against the British, the Zionists blew up the ship on Christmas Day, 1940, causing the death of 252 Jews, as well as the ship's English crewmen. If Nazis had blown up a ship of Jewish refugees in the waters of Israel, the Mossad would have hunted the perpetrators to the ends of the earth if need be, so they could be brought before Israeli war crimes courts. There would be a well-publicized annual remembrance of the terrible act of Nazi terrorism. Instead, Israel chose the murderer, in this case, the terrorist murderer of Jewish lives, as its first prime minister. Zionism and Nazism are torn from similar cloth, their banners stained with blood. Zionists, though, are infinitely better at public relations. The next section, Israel, a racist state. On November 10, 1975, a plenary session of the United Nations declared that Zionism is a form of racism. Howls of protest went up across America and throughout the world from the, once again, poor, persecuted Jews. They were furious that such a charge could have been made against the, quote, only true democracy in the Mideast, unquote. But what exactly is Zionism if it is not racism? Even David Ben-Gurion, in discussing the Hitlerism of Menachem Begin, wrote, quote, "He can be accused of racism, but then one will have to put on trial the entire Zionist movement, which is founded on the principle of a purely Jewish entity in Palestine," unquote. The International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in 1965, has now been ratified by most member states. Article 1 of this convention defines the term racial discrimination as, and I quote, "any distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preference based on race, color, descent, or national or ethnic origin, which has the purpose or effect of nullifying or impairing the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise on an equal footing of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the political, economic, social, cultural, or any other field of public life," unquote. Israel was and is a nation set up exclusively for Jews. By the Israeli law of return, a Jew is defined not by his religious beliefs, but by his Jewish ancestry, proven by the heritage of his parents. Although it is possible for Gentiles to convert to Judaism, the obstacles are so great that the converted make up only a tiny percentage of the Jewish population. As I write these lines, Jewish Orthodoxy, the state-sanctioned religion of Israel, is in a major controversy with American Reform and conservative factions because the Orthodox in Israel will not even recognize conversions from these two branches of Judaism. A Palestinian who was born within the boundaries of what is now Israel and whose family lived there for thousands of years before being forced out by the Israeli army cannot return to his homeland and become a citizen of Israel. In contrast, an atheist Jew born in New York City and who speaks no Hebrew can immigrate to Israel and be granted instant citizenship. In addition, the Israeli government offers him help for housing, living expenses, education, and besides many other numerous benefits. In 1948, nearly 94% of the land of Israel was owned by Palestinians. Since then, Palestinian-owned land has been systematically confiscated by the Israeli government. Most of the Palestinian land went into what Israel calls, quote, the National Jewish Fund, and was declared by law to be, quote, land of Israel, unquote. It has become Jewish land, and by law it can never be sold to a non-Jew, rented to a non-Jew, or worked by a non-Jew. Much of the land has been given at no cost to Jewish settlers. The Zionist army has forced the Palestinians from more than 350 cities and villages in Israel and the occupied territories, and then bulldozed their homes. Even ancient Palestinian cemeteries are often plowed under. Two other laws concern the Karin Kemiet National Jewish Fund Law, passed on 23 November 1953, and the Karin Hesod Reconstruction Fund Law, passed on 10 January 1956. The president of the Israeli Human Rights League, Dr. Israel Shahak, a professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, in his book, The Racism of the State of Israel, tells us that there are in Israel whole towns, Carmel, Nazareth, Elath, Hatzor, Arad, Midzepin, Raman, and others, where non-Jews are forbidden by law to live. The Palestinians who remained in Israel, although ostensibly citizens, suffer intense discrimination. They are given citizenship identification cards that have no Israeli nationality designation. Nationality is listed only as Arab or Jewish, lending itself to the many discriminatory policies in the Jewish state. In Israel, there are whole cities and settlements in which it is illegal for Palestinians to live. There are segregated housing areas and complexes, schools, recreational facilities where Palestinians are not allowed. This segregation is not de facto. It is official government policy. Palestinians are not permitted to serve in the military, and despite the fact that Palestinians comprise between 15 and 20% of the Israeli population, there has never been one Palestinian in the Israeli cabinet. Israeli law does not recognize the legality of marriage between Jews and Palestinians, as marriages and other aspects of civil laws are decided by religious courts, which do not recognize such marriages. Whenever I see Jews in the American media glorifying and encouraging intermarriage between blacks and whites, I think about their hypocrisy in supporting a nation that will not, by law, recognize a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. Chaim Cohen, a former judge of the Supreme Court of Israel, noted, quote, "The bitter irony of fate, which has led to the same biological and racist laws propagated by the Nazis and which inspired the infamous Nuremberg Laws, to serve as a basis for the definition of Judaism within the state of Israel." Unquote. It is quite interesting when a respected member of the Israeli Supreme Court says almost exactly the same thing about Jewish supremacism as did the much Jewish maligned Julius Streicher said at the Nuremberg trials. It is truly a world turned upside down when the same American and world press that never tires of conjuring up images of the crimes and evils of Nazism, but in turn gives a Jewish supremacist, Nazi-like nation, international deference and even adulation. As the primary founder of Israel, Ben-Gurion, admitted, "Zionism was founded on racist principles. If anyone other than a Zionist leader dares say the same thing as the Israeli founder, the world press would viciously condemn him. If by their power in the media and in the governments of the Western world, Jewish supremacists can be so effective in hiding their extreme supremacism, disguising their terrorism must seem like child's play." Having already learned a lot about terrorism and bloodthirstiness of the Jewish Bolsheviks in the early days of communism, I now decided to delve more thoroughly into an investigation of Zionist terrorism in the Mideast. A Palestinian I met in college related to me one of the most descriptive remarks that I've ever heard concerning the Palestinian conflict. He told me that, quote, "The Jew always cries in pain as he strikes you." The next chapter is chapter 23, Israel 2, Supremacism Through Terror.